Goyle, and welcome to another episode of Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. In these conversations, we introduce you to the scholars and alumni of the Arts and Humanities faculty at Vancouver Island University and discuss their latest research. I'm your host, Bryn Skibo, Professor of English at VIU. Before we start, we would like to acknowledge and give thanks to the Sonamuk, Powhatan, Tlamin, Stanawis, and Qualicum First Nations, on whose traditional lands we teach, learn, research, live, and share knowledge. Since 2009, the Faculty of Arts and Humanities has presented the Colloquium, a series of lectures that brings our faculties and alumni's practices and research to the public. In today's episode, I talk with Deborah Pentecost, Professor of Media Studies at VIU. Deborah received her doctorate in media studies from Simon Fraser University in 2002. Her dissertation, entitled War, Photojournalism, and Audiences, Making Meaning from Tragic Moments, explored the challenges, capacities, and limitations of photojournalism in war zones. In this work, and in her continuing research, Professor Pentecost has explored these and other concerns of photojournalism when chronicling the human experience, finding that there are three distinct challenges. One, how can a static visual image represent the complexity of an extremely traumatic event? Two, what are the ethical implications of creating and distributing these potentially upsetting images? And three, how, literally, can the photographer represent and distribute images of events that are sometimes actively repressed? More recently, Deborah's attention has turned to the issue of housing precarity in British Columbia. While housing in Vancouver may seem like a far cry from war zones, Deborah's research in the power of visual media highlights the power of imagery to capture human experiences and create change. On February 13th at 10 a.m., in VIU's Malaspina Theater, Deborah Pentecost will present Visual Expressions of Community, Connections, and Home, which is a collaborative photojournalism project. The project chronicles the experiences of a housing co-op in Vancouver as they fought to prevent city council from destroying their home to create a high-rise. Today, I chat with Deborah about her past and current work around the challenges and capacities of the visual image in Canada and throughout the world today. Welcome, Deborah, and thank you so much for joining me.
Welcome, Bryn. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's just jump right in. I mentioned earlier that your doctoral research was on war journalism, which I know was the topic also of your 2017 colloquium. And in reading over that material, I really appreciated the clarity that you offered in highlighting those three challenges that I mentioned at the intro to today's show. And specifically the challenges of photographing traumatic events. So I'm just curious, what drew you to this research? And was there a particular visual image that first really like captured your attention?
When I finished my master's, I had been to Ireland after I did my undergrad. And I really, for some reason, was really drawn to Ireland. And after I finished my master's, I went back and I had a work permit. So I was going to be there until I got noticed that my PhD, I was approved for the PhD program. And so it was like, okay, I'll leave Ireland and come back. But I had ended out during that, it was about a half a year that I was in Ireland, and I was going between the south and the north. And I became really intrigued by the wall murals in Northern Ireland. And so I was spending a lot of time with my camera walking and making sense of the relationship of the ways in which the murals depicted the sort of political aspirations and beliefs and situations for both the Catholics and Protestants. And so that was really... it's certainly not photojournalism, but I came back and I was really intrigued and did a sort of an abrupt turn from what I was going to be doing my PhD on. And there was the wars of the 1990s that started, and the first Gulf War, and then into Yugoslavia burning and various Rwanda. And it just kind of kept moving. I can't, how I ended up going, my supervisor wasn't tremendously excited that I was leaving what I had said I was going to do. And it just kind of morphed and it kept moving. And it kind of, then I settled into the power of the still photograph and following photojournalism. And, many people are familiar with this photograph, but I when I was in Ireland, they have really excellent newspapers. And there was a section one day where they said, this is the photograph that stopped the war in Vietnam. And so it was the photograph of the girl running down the road and the children having had napalm accidentally dropped on them. And I was always really intrigued and kept that article that it could be said that a photograph had that much power, right? And so it was really about then. It's always really fascinating to me to think about and to unpack, well, what gives the photograph its power and how can that be? There's obviously some negatives to photographs that are also because they're still, but they're often talked about in those ways, the cliches of, a photograph has a or an image has is worth a thousand words. There's just a lot to unpack in terms of how do we relate to visual images, and particularly when they're still, but also when they're moving. So somehow I ended out then focusing my PhD on the power of war photography, but really trying to unpack how audiences made sense of traumatic imagery. So I did a reception study that then, thinking through theoretically of the power of the image, then went into, okay, that's fine. We can theorize, but we're then dealing with, and I my reception study was structured so that I thought I had a variety of types of images from the war zone, and I really wanted to see how these were received, and were they able to sort of pierce through people's protective shields, or were they ones where you could just go, I've seen it a million times, it doesn't affect me, it's just another refugee from Yugoslavia or the former Yugoslavia.
Oh, that's fascinating too. I didn't even think of doing that kind of research where you actually just ask the audience rather than interpreting it yourself, but you reached out to see how are these images being received. And this idea of I think it's called compassion fatigue.
Yes, exactly.
I have I wanted to talk about that a little later on. But before we get there, to come back to this idea of the various wars that were taking place as you were thinking about your research and doing your research, I can't help that your dissertation you finished in 2002, being American, I know exactly what happened, that most people do. And so you were pursuing this research during and through the aftermath of the 2001 9/11 attacks in the United States. And unfortunately, the United States has been and is currently producing many current images of violence, public trauma, and political repression, all topics that you were pursuing at that time as well. The issues that you brought up in your research are unfortunately extremely present and current right now. I'm thinking obviously of Renee Good and Alex Preti's killings, and how they spread so rapidly across social media within minutes of having taken place. Their final moments have now been seen by millions, if not tens of millions of people. The resulting anger and collective trauma in Minneapolis have produced not just videos of their killings, but so many incredibly arresting visual images. I know from what we were just talking about that your earlier research was on war photography. But have you found yourself? I know that currently you're more looking into housing precarity and the photography of community, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But have you found yourself returning to your prior research recently?
Well, I mean, that the preoccupation with the visual is always there because then in courses that I teach and work that I've done over the years, it went from still photography into I was on the board of a documentary film festival for about 15 years in Vancouver, and so it expanded into different visual forms of representing trauma and conflict, and not necessarily always war zones per se, but definitely the challenges of how do you visualize something that is very disturbing and distressing or out of the reach of visualization, which a lot of trauma is. It is unrepresentable. And so, so that carried on from this sort of focus on photojournalism to something into different documentary and creative documentary, even animation and clay figures, all sorts of ways that you could visualize in a storytelling mode truth or true experiences, and that often were too traumatic. You couldn't show them because a lot of things that really obviously are the horrors of our world, you cannot show. And you even going into the footage of, say, Alex Preddy being shot, those kind of things. There's many who that's very traumatizing. I mean, obviously it's a traumatic event, but so yeah, there's so to come back to, so I have been thinking about it all the way through, and I've been engaging in different visual, how do you storytell in a way that you can still have audiences pay attention and not turn away. I think that's obviously often the overarching. How do you keep engagement for things that are very important but difficult?
I can imagine that question, you just are constantly turning that pebble over in your brain, because again, this is now the second time that compassion fatigue has come up, that it's so important to see these images sometimes. But this idea that you offered of claymation or animation, just a different way to express what's happening, partially almost it seems like to protect your audience, because it's so traumatic to see these images, but also partially to almost keep them more engaged and not just turn off as a
That's
form of
right.
self-protection.
That's right. That's right.
Oh,
Yeah.
that's neat.
So, yeah, because animation, like I show a film, Waltz with Bashir from 2008, which is about an Israeli soldier who was at the Sabra Shatila massacres. It's a very famous, it was a very famous animation for its moment because nobody really ever done a feature length of this nature. But he ended out going into all sorts of experiences of those in war, such as PTSD, having false memories, all of these kinds of experiences that could be shown because it was animation. So you could go into a very surreal, which he kept saying war is the most surreal experience ever, but he was able to go into those and sort of follow his own memory suppression by having this recurrent memory he had, but it never actually existed. And he kept visualizing it in an animation. And then we finally, by the end, realize, as he talks to psychotherapists, et cetera, what his mind had done in order to protect itself
Oh,
from
neat.
what he had witnessed. So all of that, you could have somebody green screened and just interview them 20 years after, this event. But he talked about the merits of animation for being able to allow, and also, when I show it to students, they're also able to watch in a way that they would not have been ever. A lot of it, at any sort of ethical boundary around what you can show, typically would have been exceeded.
That makes sense, and that answers another question that's been rumbling around in my mind of teaching these difficult images, teaching these difficult concepts to students. And so it's they're an audience just like any other. One thing that I really have been looking forward to asking you is the proliferation of AI doctored images. Obviously, in the aftermath of Minneapolis, but even just just every day, we are seeing increases of what people are calling AI slop across all of social media. There are deepfake videos. There's altered imagery now being released by government social media accounts. In my research for this interview, I came across Alan Yaman, the CEO of CopyLeaks, which is a suite of tools to help detect AI content. Yaman has argued that all of this proliferation of AI imagery will lead to, quote, authenticity collapse. In other words, people are inundated with AI material, resulting in believability fatigue, where we just don't have the energy to sort out what's real and what isn't, leading us to believe that everything and nothing is real all at the same time. How do you feel about the rise of AI images? Do you think that an authenticity collapse can reduce the power of visual images?
Thank you. That's a really excellent question, and for doing that little bit of research, because I wasn't familiar with either of those terms, the authenticity collapse and this believability fatigue. I think it's really interesting. It kind of reminds me of what's happening outside of just the visual, which is this inundation of misinformation, disinformation, a similar kind of where I think parallel, I talk to my students about it as well, is just what do they have to do in order to be able to trust what they're seeing? And it's very exhausting. There's all these processes you have to sort of go through, and do you do them? Do you double and triple and go to various sources, etc.? Because you never know whether what you're seeing is true, or it's been planted or created by Fred down the road. And so the AI, I think what's really interesting about the visual in particular is that's obviously where its truth factor has always resided, is that, you know, like if you go to, I talk to my students, for example, about if we're going to define the power of the still photo, and how does it function? One of them is that it functions to say something happened. Like if you go to the criminal court, if you go to The Hague, visual evidence is submitted to say not that it's a fabulous photo and it'll be an icon. It's submitted because it says this happened on this day.
Yeah.
And I remember with the former Yugoslavia, one of the generals whose name I can't remember, but he was convicted on the basis of footage that included street names.
Oh.
And so they were able to say it was his own troops that had recorded it. And they were able, he said, I was never there. And then this footage showed, yeah, no, he was. And then, of course, you knew the time. And so they were able to say, no, this, you know, whatever had happened. So that truth function of so much of photography and visual and moving, not just still, but just visual evidence, that's part of its power, is really to say this happened. And so it takes us into Rene Good and Alex Preti, where you bring up, and the power of obviously that has started with Rodney King, is that the tools are in many people's hands to be able to record and disseminate the footage of police brutality, if this is, you know, just to speak about that one thing. But then even going all the way back to Rodney King, what would be thought of as being obvious evidence of excessive brutality, you can, you know, as happened, slow down the footage and go, no, the police were acting completely according to appropriate levels what they can do with somebody they've apprehended. And so you could play with what you'd think was a slam dunk case of, oh my God, can you imagine? Look at this citizen journalist, one of the first cases, right?
Yeah.
So the same thing I'm hearing happening, I heard some individuals were doing AI versions of Alex Preti's murder. And then I went, oh, this is too macabre, right? So they, in a celebratory way, and so creating almost like snuff films.
Yes. Yes. I didn't even think of that. Wow.
So, you know, again, when one thinks it's absolutely sort of a shut and dry case, and that it will be interpreted. But that's also the problem of the visual, is that no, it only records, it has no context. You can fill it in. We might be
Right.
able to hear people speaking, but that's about all we can do in moving footage. So that doesn't answer the specific question, but yeah, I do think that the believability fatigue and the authenticity collapse, I think that they do exist and they do run parallel to what has happened just in the online sphere in general.
Yeah. I mean, it's also a bit of an unanswerable question to post, like, how do we fix? But you raise really good points that, yes, there is this rise. Yes, people are using it for really macabre, as you said, purposes, really dangerous purposes. But at the counter is this other point that you mentioned of everybody can be a citizen journalist because we all have phones in our pockets. So,
Yeah.
yeah, I guess it's nice to view it more as not this overwhelming wave of AI slop. There is the counterbalance, and that really emphasizes the importance of citizens within a photographing democracy. That's
Yeah, I
but
mean, I just had a student present yesterday in a class which is propaganda, persuasion, and promotion, and they ended out their focus was on Kristi Noem's statement at the FEMA office. So it was the visual of her responding to Alex Preti's shooting by the police. And she said the New York Times had actually done a really excellent by the second, where they're literally showing the cameras in his hand. And so she's got this little box drawn around what is in his hand, and it's his phone all the way through, right? And obviously somebody else has their phone, and all of these recording devices are there.
I would be remiss. Thank you so much for all of these just really important points so far, just about the power of journalism. I would be remiss, obviously, if we didn't talk a little bit about your colloquium. I want to make sure that we don't have too many spoilers because I want listeners to come and see the colloquium. But your upcoming colloquium is based on a photo voice project that you produced, and I believe is a publication, is going to become a publication.
Yes, we have a photo book.
Yes, the photo book. As I mentioned earlier, these images of community, isolation, barriers, and joy, they seem like a big jump away from your previous research, but both your doctoral project and this project highlight the power of, as you've pointed out, the power of the visual image. Did you think there was a large jump, or did you find any like surprising similarities in looking at your earlier research and now your research very much at home?
I'm always interested in methods of research, and so I teach a methods class, and I teach visual methods as well. And so I knew about photo voice. There were various ways of doing visual research and visual methods, but photo voice was this really interesting collaborative method. And so I ended out in 2019, I ended out teaming up with a Nanaimo-based organization, Seniors Connect, who had a mandate that they were aiming to deal with isolation and sort of stigmas for seniors in Nanaimo. And so I ended out doing a photo voice project and partnering with Seniors Connect. And so they ended out sending out my stuff. And so a group came together and did something very similar to what the project is for the colloquium. So that's really where. It's not that it's obviously related to what I did and have done all the way through with my PhD and onwards, but it does go into visual methods and this really sort of collaborative and the power of the image to the I think what happens with both the Seniors Connect and then in my current project is it's the partnership between the photographs that the individuals take and then how they describe them. So it's almost like poetry. The two go together. So you're looking at sometimes very mundane images, but because of the way that they're written up and the meaning that they have for the person that took them, then it's a so you because of course photographs are just ambiguous. So it's a really perfect They can become really powerful, even though you're looking at something where you go, it's just a boot,
Right.
right?
Oh,
So they're really lovely. Many of them are really lovely. And somebody handed out when we had a sort of visitor's book to sign. Somebody said that it was a love letter to the co-op.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, so I thought, well, that's a really lovely way to, and I think it really functioned a lot in that way.
I think that is a beautiful place for us to wrap up the conversation. We started pretty heavy and we ended up with photography can act as a love letter to community and home. So thank you so much, Deborah, for joining me today. For listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation, I hope you'll join us at Malaspina Theater on Friday, February 13th from 10 a.m. to 11:30 to experience Deborah's visual presentation, Visual Expression of Community, Connections, and Home. The lecture will start shortly after 10 a.m. with a question and answer session and refreshments to follow. More information is available at ah.viu.ca/colloquium series, or you can just Google VIU Colloquium. We'll be back on March 25th at 10 a.m. on CHLY 101.7 FM when I chat with Justin McGrail, professor of art history, about what happens when we bring graffiti or street art off the streets and into the gallery and auction house. Deborah, again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Bryn.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities, technical production by R.B. Frew at CHLY 101.7 FM, with thanks to Tyla and Carter, our student radio technicians. You can hear this interview again, as well as all of our archived episodes, at the Conversations website, www.conversationspodcast.ca. Many thanks to McLean, our student website editor, who manages the Conversations Podcast website. I'm your host, Bryn Skibo. Thanks again for listening.